Cathy Kelly is one of Ireland's best known, best loved and most prolific authors. She's just published her 23rd novel. Yeah, you heard it right. 23rd novel. It's called Sisterhood. And like any author has to do when they publish a new book, Cathy has been doing lots of media appearances to promote it. However, this hasn't been a typical promotion tour for Cathy because she's been receiving treatment for a very serious type of cancer over the past few months. And it's had a very, very big impact on her day-to-day life, leaving her very sick, very tired and fatigued. However, Cathy is remarkably positive about everything. And the woman I met in studio just a couple of days ago was full of energy, chatty, perky, sparky, reflective, mischievous, and a whole lot of fun.
I was very conscious. I didn't want to be judged. But at this point, I'm like, well, you know, people will like you or not like you, as the case may be. Yeah. And other people's opinion of me is none of my business. This is me. This is my truth. You know, people would always ask us loads of questions, which was, did you always want to be a writer? And the joke was, one of us was going to say one day, no, I wanted to be a porn star. I've already said it. I said it before, but I still haven't won the bet. And we didn't set on what the
Who did you say to? Pat Kenny?
No, I didn't.
When did you want to be a writer? And you went, I wanted to be a porn star, Pat. Oh my God, why do they always make me look like a plank?
I began to think about mortality when I had my kids, because suddenly I was thinking, I have to be there for them and I will, you know, kill to be there. And having cancer just pushes that a bit more, because it's like, OK, I really, really have to work hard at being there for them. And it's very, very powerful.
David Beckham used to wear 23.
Oh, was that it? Oh, dude,
for a reason, I think.
Beckham, I know. So cute until he started to talk. God love him. I know. But really? I mean, really?
And Cathy, believe it or not, was a very popular guest with some of the callers that were listening live to our podcast this week. None other than Bertie Ahern, Roy Keane and Paul Williams phoned in to chat with her. And you'll catch those calls towards the end of our chat, which Cathy dealt with really, really well. But before we get to Cathy, comedy. Because, listen, this week it's all about Cillian Murphy. Can he win the Oscar for Ireland? Well, for himself, really. And become only the third person ever born in Ireland to win an Oscar. I think Brenda Fricker and Barry Fitzgerald were the other two. Although we all have a soft spot for Daniel Day-Lewis, who, of course, is an Irish citizen as well and been living in Ireland for years. But anyway, typically, the Mario Rosenstock podcast got a hold of Cillian Murphy's voicemails.
Hi, you've reached Cillian Murphy. Leave a message after the tone. No Hollywood bullshit, please. Cheers.
Cillian! Oh, it's Al Pacino. I got your number from Chris Nolan, good friend of mine. Wow, I see we're sitting beside each other at the Oscar ceremony. I'm C3, row 15. Whoa, have you seen the goodie bags? Whoa, make yourself known to me, Murphy!
Cillian, this is Michael Douglas. Listen, pal. I got your number from Harve Weinberg at CAA. His secretary, Marcia, gave it to me. Let's pencil in a meeting for Monday morning after the Oscars. I have a couple of propositions involving Michael Collins, Eamon Devalira. I'd like to run across you and your team. Thanks, pal.
Hey, Cillian. It's Matthew McConaughey. Hey. All right. I ain't got a dog in this fight, so I ain't gonna bite. I wanna wish you all the best on Sunday night. And just keep living, boy. Just keep living. When they call your name, and I know they will. Ba-da-bum, 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 ba-da-bum. Just keep staring. Don't flinch for 1 second. All right.
Cillian. Wow, it's Owen Wilson here. I just saw Oppenheimer. Wow, it's so amazing the way you do it, man. Let's hang out. God, you're so incredible.
Okay, so let's cross straight over to the studio where Cathy Kelly has been waiting patiently. She's one of Ireland's most popular writers and prolific too, 23 novels under her belt. And that's where we start proceedings.
I wanted to talk to you about your writing, and I wanted to talk to you about your career as a writer and your genesis as a writer. There's a lot of writers nowadays, Cathy. What I mean by that is there's a lot of people who suddenly decide to become writers. And I don't mean that in a negative way or anything. But there are people who do this, that and the other. And then they go, do you know what I'm going to do as well? I'm going to add writer to my CV. And they all, yeah. Do you know what they go as well? Not only am I going to add writer to my CV, I'm going to add children's writer to my CV.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a children's book. I don't think, I've never been, there's been no indication in the past that you had any interest in not only books, but children either. And now you're a children's author. Fair play to you. But anyway.
It's a weird one, and occasionally people do that. And I often wonder how this comes about. Does the person sit there and go, do you know, we're not making enough money from the T-shirts, I'm going to write a children's book. I don't know whether that's where it comes from.
I think what people do is, Cathy, they leverage their celebrity and they go, if I use my my good name as a celebrity, I can leverage it to, you know, get kids to buy stuff based on role models and stuff like that.
I remember when Katie Price or Jordan, as she will always be to me, started writing the kids' pony books, and I remember thinking, oh, I don't know about this. I'm not entirely sure because, in a role model-y way. You know, I mean, who am I to talk about role models?
Yeah,
you know?
Fair enough, yeah.
But at the same point, I used to think, well, having masses of surgery in a, you know, and that's, I don't mean that in a picking on her sort of way. I mean, the world that she was living in was demanding this, and she was caught up in this world of, gosh, yes, I must do
but
something
I never
else
read
extreme.
Them, so I never read them. So
no, neither did
maybe
I.
Maybe it did reflect a reality that maybe the ponies all had Botox.
Maybe
the ponies had mane replacements.
No, do you know what it would be? It would be like the moms that that liked her would say, we'll get that. And you know what? There's a plus there in maybe there were people who weren't readers. It's like anything that gets people reading is brilliant.
Yes.
But it never lasts. I think that sort of, that area never lasts, in my opinion.
But the reason I bring this point up, of course, is because you were a writer. And you were a writer through and through.
I've been doing it for a very long time.
This is a compliment. You've been doing it for a very long time. It seems from reading about you that as long as you can remember, you always wanted to be a writer. Why did you always want to be a writer? And is that true? Did you want to be a writer since you were young?
I did, but I didn't really think that I could possibly attain it. I mean, I learned to read early and I lived in the world of books. I mean, I think books were, I don't know, escaping into my head was the most joyful thing in my life. And I was always living some fantasy world where I was, I'm talking about horses. I read these amazing Australian books written by this Australian writer, the Silver Brumby books. Mm. And they were all from the point of view of horses, these wild horses in Australia. So for there was a while when I was a wild horse, and Freudians among you can make what you will out of that. But so I loved reading, and I was in my head. And I used to tell stories to my little sister. I used to tell stories to myself. I mean, don't we? The stories you tell yourself are very powerful. But I didn't think that I could become a writer. You know, people in school now, they will see people in their 20s writing books, which is brilliant. So they can look to that and go, OK, I'm going to try that. They can find their voice early. But with me, I ended up almost by default doing journalism. I went to Rathmines for 2 years along with Paul Williams, who you've had on here.
That's right.
And then Paul and I were hired at the same time in the Sunday World. So yeah, there you are now. And
so you're taking a note now.
You're taking a note. Yes, me and Paul. We were the Dempsey and the Makepeace of the Sunday World. Yes, and not many people remember Dempsey or Makepeace.
I do.
Yeah,
they
me too.
Kind
me
of a crime duo.
They got married and everything in real life. Yeah. I loved that. But I didn't think you could do it as a job, which sounds really, really stupid because there were no young people. Everyone was older. And there was a lot of, I think at the time, you know, female writers were older, or they were writing about different things, or they were, we'll say, wonderful Edna O'Brien. You know, they were adults and they were writing about a different time. Mm. And then Maeve Binchy was writing about a different time. I mean, her first book was starts off in the 40s. So Light a Penny Candle. Mm. So the notion of writing about the world we live in seemed too alien. And then I remember Patricia Scanlon came along, wonderful Patricia, who sent me a text as I was coming in here. And yes, and she said, I hope you're relaxing. And I didn't reply and say, I'm belting along the road because I'm going to be late. Anyway. So when she came out with City Girl, her first book, and yes. I'm trying to remember what year it was, I suddenly thought, oh, so you can be Irish and you can write about modern Irish women, and like, that's okay. So that was an enormous push for me. And mind you, it took me a while to get going.
Yeah. So it's seeing your contemporaries in action that...
Seeing that you could do it, that you could write a book
yeah.
about modern Irish women.
Yeah, isn't that something okay. though? Isn't that something? And that applies to everything in the professional world, everything in yeah. the arts. You need to see somebody who you know
yes.
doing it.
Yes.
To understand truly that you can do it.
That you can do it too. And I mean, the hilarious thing is, as a writer, I spend an awful lot of my time going, I'm a moron. I'm a complete moron. Mm. But I think that's part of the process.
Being self-critical.
Yes. Mm. Or please tell me it's part of the process, or otherwise I'm going to have to get more tablets. I mean...
So you were... Probably a lot of writers are very self-critical. I mean, because what is a writer? A writer is not only a thinker and a storyteller, it's also an editor. A writer is a natural editor. And editors, by their nature, must be critical to edit. So if you're going to edit yourself, you must be critical of yourself.
I reached an amazing point a few books ago, where instead of writing down the sentence and going, do you know what, I'm not sure about that sentence, I would think the sentence, go, I'm not sure about that sentence, and not even, you know, I was cutting out the middleman, not even write it down. So I said, you know, the thing that I will always say to people I'm mentoring is, you've got to write something down, you know, get it down on paper. And that can be the tricky bit, getting it down on paper and not deleting it immediately and going, that's brutal. But and you think I'd have it together after 23 books, but maybe that little hint of anxiety is very important. I mean, I know comedians, artists, fashion designers, loads of other writers, and that is a big part of it, that, oh God, is that okay? As you know, yeah. am I being stupid here? Mm-hmm.
It's questioning.
Yeah, I know.
And that comes with a certain amount of anxiety, and that's exactly what you need.
Yes, a certain amount.
Not too much.
I know.
Just a little bit. Goldilocks level.
Goldilocks. Yeah, isn't there a Goldilocks level with the universe? There is, what is it, the Goldilocks area?
Goldilocks planets.
Yes, Goldilocks planets. That's it. Where
they are
could be
planets
life.
Which are just far enough away from a local star that they can
have life.
They can house life.
There we go. That's it. I knew
Goldilocks
something
planets.
I'm glad you finished that, because I know a teeny bit about a lot of things.
Yeah,
and I can never finish the sentence.
That's a lot of writers like you know a little bit about a lot of things.
Yeah, I know.
Because it informs their books. But before you became a novelist, you were, as you said, a journalist in the Sunday World. And what kind of stuff did you write? Was it?
Well,
as you said, Paul Williams there. Were you a crime writer?
I wasn't a crime writer. Paul and I were hired at the same time, and we were hired to be news reporters. And this, there were no jobs. This was, I did my interview in 1986, sort of when I came out of journalism college. And, there were no jobs. So I just was going for everything, and this was a full-time job. So it was a news reporter, and I would not have been, by any stretch of the imagination, a good fit for a news reporter. Mm. I know that now as a big grown-up, but at the time I thought, yeah, I'll do this, be no bother. So I was hired along with Paul, and I was possibly the worst news reporter ever.
Okay.
Well, maybe that's cruel.
Because you were making up stories, were you?
No. No. But the thing is...
The woman apparently fell from the window. Then, after that, she stabbed her husband to death. No, she didn't really. I'm just making that up.
No, do you know what the hard thing was, right? So Paul, with the sort of person, Paul would go off and he'd find a story anywhere. You know, we would be sent down the country, someone would say, go to Cork for a week and get stories. I mean, this was my ultimate nightmare, because the way I got a story was if the news editor said, this is something, go out and report on it. Or if someone rang in, quite often people would ring in and they would think we were the news of the world, and I would not disabuse them of this notion. I'd go, yeah, we're the news of the world, keep going. Just, you're talking to me. And then work on it or do a follow-up of something. But going out and finding some little nugget and crafting, you know, extracting the information, I was brutal at it. I really was. So I segued eventually.
What was that world like in the Sunday World? What was that atmosphere like?
Oh, it was interesting. I mean, it was, you know, there were a lot of... News was king. I mean, news was absolutely king. So to get the front page lead story, the splash... That was, you know, baby, you were rocking then. And I was very rarely that person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you'd have nothing in the paper at all. Mm. And my grandmother would be like, she's nothing in the paper, have they fired her? And, you know, I'd be going, I have nothing in the paper. So at that point, I began to think, hold on, this news thing isn't really working out. So I'd go through the files, I'd look up ideas for bigger stories, for features. Because a lot of our stuff was, you know, the featurey stuff was bought in, like Hollywood stuff, you know. And we, you know, various columnists, it was bought in. So suddenly I began to say, well, why don't we write a big article about, I don't know, child abuse or domestic abuse, or, you know, we were always writing about drugs. Let's talk about the people, you know, the families that were left behind, stuff like that. So I did a lot of that stuff and I loved it. I loved people, the people behind the stories. I love people. And it was very hard because these were dark stories. They weren't little happy things.
No.
And then I also, so within this, I became the film critic, which was completely fabulous because it meant you could go into town in the morning and be there with your coffee at 10:30 and sit in the Savoy One down the back and watch a film. And the problem was I was probably not serious enough as a film critic in that if I didn't like it, I think, well, I don't like this and I'm not wasting the rest of the day. So I would just belt out and go into Miss Selfridge next door, which is probably, a proper film critic is probably supposed to stay to the end.
But again, I was like, another perfect opportunity to invent the end of the film that didn't exist, hence how you became a writer.
No.
I loved this film, The Silence of the Lambs, particularly how the victims fall in love with Hannibal and they go off into the sunset on horses.
Do you know what? I just read a book recently by a woman called Yana Monroe, who was the person that Clarice was based on. There we go. Can you hear the sheep screaming? Was it sheep or pigs?
Lambs.
Lambs, that was it. Silence of the Lambs. Duh. Yeah, so, and then I was also the Agony Aunt. I know you're getting on to that. Everyone loves the Agony Aunt stuff. They really do.
And when I think of Agony Aunt now, all I think of is Doughty O'Shea.
Oh, but
he's,
you know,
an Agony Aunt.
I know he is, but he does it very well and it's very nice. Do you know what I mean? It's lovely. I love Doughty. There's a great... You know, it's sensible and it's gentle, right? And obviously, he's not, you know, doing really dark stories. We had an agony aunt and she didn't use her real name. And then I got the job and they said, we'll use your real name, of course. And I was too thick to see that this might be a, you know, possible problem. So it was Dear Kathy. And I mean, you know, God, being out in the real world when people, you know, people had come up to you at parties and nightclubs and, you know, try and mortify you. So I just used to say... loudly, keep rubbing the cream on it and the rash will go away. And that shut people up.
That got rid of them fairly rapidly.
That got rid of them, I know.
Okay, so how and when did your career as a journalist kind of come to an end and your career as a writer proper start?
Ooh, well, I think I was in my late 20s. I was 27 and I had a couple of abortive, I'm going to write a book. My mother and I had tried to write a Mills and Boone when I was in college, which had not worked out at all well. I don't know how two people can write a book. It's hilarious because she wasn't...
Your mother had yourself.
My mother, we decided. My mother should definitely have written.
Yeah.
And she'd write a bit in a notebook in longhand and her writing and my handwriting, both appalling.
So that is fascinating.
And so I'd come home and I had this secondhand golf ball typewriter with a dodgy E, right? So you can see the problems already. And so I would type up and she'd say, you know, heroin goes into room, describe room. Anyway, look, it went nowhere fast. And then my father also actually decided that he was going to write a Mills and Boone. I think that went even less far because he had never read a Mills and Boone. But, you know, we were all at it.
Oh, Jesus, that sounds like a book in itself.
I know.
That sounds like a Netflix series.
Do you know what?
The three of the family are trying to write Mills and Boone.
Yeah, Mills and Boone and nobody going anywhere. So then... when I was in my early 20s, I tried to write what we call a Clogs and Shawl novel.
Oh.
So Clogs and Shawl basically sort of says sort of 17th, 18th, 19th century.
Oh, yes. And everyone, Jane Austen.
Well, yeah, except that it's, you know, everyone is a peasant, everyone is poor, everyone is on a ship going to Australia, having stolen a loaf of bread to keep the family alive. Okay. And yeah, so I didn't really read those sort of books. It's a long story.
Kind of an emigrant's story.
So anyway, we will move fast past that. So I was 27, started writing the sort of book I'd like to read, and that was it. And I just sit there at night and I would say, I'll sit down for half an hour now, and 3 hours later I'd still be at it.
Yeah. And isn't this when you know in life that you found what you want to do, that moment where you realise 3 hours have passed and you didn't see the time?
I know, it's absolutely incredible. Isn't it joyous?
Yes.
Wonderful joy. And we are terribly lucky to have that.
You're right, Cathy. And anybody who's listening, this is what, you're younger maybe and you're thinking what to do with my life. Find something where the time disappears like that and you will always be happy.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Find something that you love doing, and they say you'll never work a day in your life. I'm not so sure about that, but I loved it. So I sent the beginnings of this novel off to an Irish publisher and they, well, eventually I had to ring them. I had to chase them. And they said, oh, we'd love to publish it. And, you know, where's the rest of it? So
really? So you got off to a very lucky start.
I was very lucky, but I had to then write the rest of it because being a typical journalist, you know,
But they liked the start of it.
They liked the start of it. Exactly. So I had to write the rest of it. And then I'd started my second book and a UK company came in and bought me off the Irish publisher. And then suddenly, that was the first time I made any money.
So there was a bit of heat around your first book.
There was a bit. Well, amazingly, it went to number one. It stayed number one for 8 weeks. And of course, in typical Irish fashion, I was slightly morto about this, do you know? And I'd be in the little teeny weeny little coffee nook in the office and someone would come in and say, how's the book doing? Is it number one? I was going, yeah, number one again. And I'd be almost embarrassed. Mm. What are we like as a nation? Or, you know, it's like, God forbid that you do anything that works out.
I know.
So,
isn't it terrible?
I know, it'd be like if you won an award. Yeah, I got the pre-dunner, but you know, whatevs.
Yeah. I'm sorry I did that.
Yeah, I know.
It's like that thing that Irish people, I don't think there's any other society that says sorry more than we do.
Oh my God.
We could be knocked over by somebody on the street and we'll say sorry.
Do you know
what? A lorry could run you over and I'll go, sorry. Sorry.
Listen,
for being run over.
That is one of the themes. Like, I'm not just saying this to say, let's talk about my book, but I swear to God, one of the themes of the book is that I have a woman who is Tony. She's one of the main characters and she mentors women in business. And this lovely woman comes into her and, you know, she's very pretty and, you know, she's in a big company and she's trying to move on, but she's pretty, she's petite, she's the sort of person who might get patted on the head. Do you know what I mean? Just because she's a particular physical type. I personally was once patted on the head by a boss. So anyway, I don't know where that came from. So my character, Tony, says, what's your most used word? And the girl goes, sorry? And she goes, that's your most used word. And it's true. We say yes. Sorry so much. Yes. So it's learning how to say sorry and learning that no is a complete sentence. This is my message today.
Okay, so just roll it back there a second ago. Yeah. So really what you're saying, now this is only factual, right? So really what you're saying is your first book was actually surprisingly successful.
In Ireland only. It was only in Ireland, yeah.
Okay, but it got you off to a great start.
Fabulous, yeah.
And that basically kick-started your
the whole
entire
thing.
Career.
Yeah.
And you've never looked back since then, is that right?
Yes, never looked
back. Book after book after book after book.
Yeah.
Okay. I have two questions for you. What is a day in the life of a writer like you, your day in the life of a writer? What does it look like? And the second question is, has that changed over the years? So what is a day like? What time do you get up? How does it start? I want some nitty-gritty detail.
Oh, the nitty-gritty.
Nitty-gritty. I want coffees, teas.
Oh,
I want
listen.
Smokes. I want anything.
Far too much toffee and key. Yeah, far too much of that. Well, it was slightly easier when my kids were going to school. I'd bring them to school. I'd come home, maybe walk the dogs, you know, throw on a wash, you know, the endless. When you work from home, you're always throwing on a wash or going in going, geez, I have to put the clothes out. Anyway, throw on a wash, get a cup of coffee. The only thing I always had, I'd have a cup of coffee beside the desk and then have the dogs in with me.
So this is about 9 o'clock now, is it?
Yeah. Mm. And I'd just work. And on a really good day, I would just, you know, I move, you know, I say, oh, I'll get up now and I'll get another cup of tea and I get a chewy for the dogs or whatever. Go in and out, you know, doing the washing machine, making more coffee, have lunch standing up. I would always have lunch standing up. I say, I just have a few crackers and cheese and sit back at the desk. And then as soon as it's time to get my kids, go and get the kids and that's it. Work is over. Mm. And then it's just, you know, cooking dinner and they be doing their homework and totally, it's like a totally normal day for someone who works from home. That's it. There's no excitement.
So what you try to apply to it is almost like an office day.
Yeah.
I'm going to work like kind of 9 to 12, have something to eat, and then 1 to 4.
Because there's no point waiting for some muse. I would sign, like the way it works for me, and for most writers who would say, write in 2 or 3 book contracts, is you sign a contract for 2 or 3 books, and there are, you know, they say, well, we're expecting this book on this date. So you know that you have to deliver the book in a year. So there's no point saying, I'm going to wait till it all works out. And I don't think writing works like that. I think writing is a muscle. You've read all your life. You're reading. You're using this. You're thinking about this precious book.
Do you think the act of writing itself, literally writing, as in physically writing, putting pen to paper, do you write with pen or?
No, I type. And type. I find it very hard to actually write pen-wise because in journalism, I learned how to do shorthand. Mm. So when I write shorthand and then I go, what was that? Because I can't read it. But with, I type.
And do you think the act of writing, the physical act of typing out the letters and words in keys, or in my case, when I write, I just write with a pen, that it leads to further ideas itself?
Oh, totally.
Literally the act of writing.
Oh, Absolutely. It's just, it's like sometimes it's like, you know, you feel, and this is going to sound stupid, but it feels like it's just coming down from somewhere else. It's being given to you. Yes. It's like you're, which probably means that your subconscious brain opened and is letting all this stuff come out. And, you know, the last year, whatever, somebody said something to you, some notion that you heard of. It's all flooding out if you let it, if it's working properly.
I'm fascinated because I thought about it before. The two things I've thought about in relation to this subject are conversing, as in talking with another person, and writing.
Yep.
So when you talk to another person, have you ever noticed that when you're having a discussion with somebody and you're talking about something like, let's say, ideas, or even let's say the referendum or something, or you're talking about an argument, do you know while you're talking, much more ideas are coming into your head? So in other words, it's almost the act of vocalizing that's triggering something in your brain that is obviously engaging some subconscious thought process.
Absolutely.
That we're not aware of.
No,
similarly, the pen does it as well.
Oh, no, the writing, there are so many things that trigger that off. Actually, it's amazing. There hasn't been a neurological study. There possibly has been a neurological study into that. I love reading those neurological books because it's just, you know, how your brain works. Mm. It was like, what was that one? Blink, the Malcolm Gladwell one, where he talks about the subconscious brain, and they had this game with card players and with ordinary people, and the, you know, like one of the decks, they played with two decks, and one of the decks was heavily shuffled, so they were going to lose, and the gamblers subconsciously figured it out long before their brain, like they sentiently figured it out. And I think the brain works just so mysteriously. You know, it's like your brain is working away there in the background, and occasionally it even lets it into the frontal cortex.
So this is what I'm interested in, right? So I was saying to Cabrina earlier on before we came on, we were just talking about what I was doing, right? And I had written a sketch for tomorrow. So there's a sketch going out tomorrow, and the subject of the sketch is Michael D is in the hospital.
I know,
right?
Poor bunny.
So that's the subject of my sketch. So now I heard that Michael D is fine.
Good.
He has what's called a mild transient weakness.
Oh, I know.
Now, mild transient weakness to me sounds like you're grand.
I know.
Now, and let's hope he is.
I know, I do hope he is, but I don't like the word transient, but keep going.
Okay, so anyway, what I've done is I've written a sketch for tomorrow in which, the comic element of it is Michael D encounters the HSE. So Michael D starts on a trolley in St. James's, and he's there for 4 hours, and the nurses treat him like everybody else. And then he ends up in a semi-private ward with Jerry and Peter, who are two old codgers discussing their shingles. Michael D ends up is flicking around cash in the attic watching TV, and he won't eat the food they give him. But my point is, when I started writing that idea, Michael D goes to St. James's Hospital. By the time I'd written L of Hospital, another idea for the sketch had come into my mind, and I just kept writing. So I'd written about 7, 8, 9 little notions in my mind, and it was because of the act of thumbing the keys.
Yes, it's like it is almost miraculous. And it is clearly, I mean, our brains are such spectacular pieces of machinery, aren't they? The way we can think, and the way new ideas come to us. And it is that gift of imagination. And people who don't have imagination don't understand how it works, because they could not say, they probably say to you, how do you come up with that? But to you, it's as simple as breathing.
But you see, I think I disagree with you, because I think everybody has an imagination. I think it's more a case of letting the portal open. I often use this example about creativity, that it's Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones.
Keith.
Yeah, man, Keith.
I love Keith.
And they'd go like, Keith, like you and Mick Jagger are two of the greatest songwriting combination of all time. And he says, how do you come up with this piece of music? And he went, man, I don't come up with any of them, man. They're already out there.
Oh.
What I do is I just, like, open myself up, man. And I just get ready to receive them. And if I'm lucky, a little plum will fall from the tree, man.
Oh.
And I'll pluck it. And in it'll go.
That
the act of creativity is to open yourself up to the creativity, not to force it. Let the play happen.
Let
the love of the thing that you're doing happen. And that's basically what you've been saying.
Yeah.
And
it just comes in. But Keith, I mean, Keith is amazing.
Yeah.
Isn't
but
he?
That you sitting down at a table and writing, it leads, one thing leads to another, and leads to another, and leads to an idea. And suddenly, as you said, 3 hours have gone by, and you may decide at the end of that 3 hours, well, that a good bit of that was useful. This is a hard question to answer. Do you think that writers get better as they get more experienced and older?
Oh, no, I absolutely think so. Because you're doing it more. I remember with my first book, you know, the simple act of having someone, would say, cross the room. I was thinking, how am I going to get them across the room? Now, I mean, I read nonstop, but suddenly you're sitting down looking at this page going, OK, I want to have her across the room and look out the window. And it never occurred to me was she looked out the window. You know, like people could figure out that she had to walk across the room, you know. So that sounds so stupid, but it's like you're... Nobody has taught you this. You are just going into it blind. I've read a lot of books. I'm going to try and write one. I didn't do any, you know, creative courses. So that was difficult. But now as I write, I can see so much more fluidity and knowledge, I hope. I mean, I can see it. Maybe nobody else can see it. And wisdom and all sorts of stuff. So it makes it a very exciting time, to be honest with you. It really does. It's exciting. I'm, you know, today was a busy day and I didn't get to do any writing. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow because I will be sitting down at my desk because it's wonderful. And you get such a buzz out of doing it because I always think that is my primary, you know, job. Well, being a mom was my primary job, but now my children are older. Yeah. So, yeah, so writing, wow. Primary job.
So how many books have you written?
This Sisterhood is number 23. I know, it's phenomenal. Obviously, I started when I was 12.
23 is a lucky number.
Is 23 in which culture?
It's regarded as a lucky number in Western culture for some reasons. Yeah, David Beckham used to wear 23.
Oh, was that it? Oh, dude,
for a reason, I think.
Beckham, I know, so cute until he started to talk. God love him. I know, but really, I mean, really, you know,
he looked great with your haircut.
Yes, yeah, I know. I mean, at the moment, the thing about my haircut at the moment is I'm like a little tennis ball and it's fluffy, but I've had it dyed, I've had it bleached. And that's the fun thing, because pre that it was grey and white, which I have no problem with. But it was also brown, my original colour.
It suits you because you're petite.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'm less petite than I was. I'll tell you, once you come off the chemo, then you were like, where's the chocolate? Yeah, that's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So there is an elephant in the room that the listeners to the Marion Rosenstock podcast might not be fully aware of, but I didn't really want it because.
Because
you're not defined by cancer. You're defined by being a writer and by being a mum.
I know, I'm absolutely not defined by cancer, but I think it's useful to talk about it because when I was diagnosed...
Tell me about it. What is it?
Well, I was diagnosed with HER2 positive cancer in the end of July last year. And, you know, at the time, I just was like, oh my God, I want to know more, which is my answer to everything. I mean, I went in to have, you know... My children, their twins, to hospital, and I brought three books with me, and they were books about, you know, having babies and looking after babies. You know, my attitude is always, let's bring a book, let's read about it. And now, of course, we have the internet, which is way better. So I was mad to read about, you know, chemo and cancer and my cancer, and it was hugely powerful and helpful to me to talk to other people who had gone through chemo and who'd gone through cancer. So it seemed to me to be a no-brainer just to talk about it. I know people, I know people who've gone through cancer who would not talk about it in a million years because they've had a hideous experience and it's so private. And there are lots of things that I don't talk about. But I found this easy to talk about because it seems like a helpful thing to do. And I don't know, maybe as you get older, you get better at talking about things. I mean, I'm 57 now, so...
Yeah, you do. I found that about myself. I think that it was just, I've said this to a few people, but that idea of a classical kind of life path often takes the form of kind of not knowing what you want at all when you're in your 20s. Maybe if you're lucky, finding something in your 30s, getting better at it, working really, really hard through your 40s, and then you're hopefully being some form of success. And then at some time around the end of your 40s or the beginning of your 50s, this unavoidable, inescapable reality comes back to you. Your head comes up for a moment. Mm. You look around and you go, well, hang on, where's all that time gone? What have I been doing? What's it all about? Who am I? Who are my family?
Yeah.
What's my relationship with the world and my family? Yeah. And who am I? And actually, who am I, really?
Yeah, very much. Who am I?
And to that extent, that little bit of self-awareness helps you, I think, to talk a little bit more. No, and to not fear talking.
I think with me, it's the not fearing talking. I think I've always had the self-awareness, but the fearing talking, because I don't know, I think it was as a journalist looking at, you know, I was a film critic, you go and you interview people and you make this snap judgment on them, and snap judgments are made on people all the time. So I was very conscious I didn't want to be judged. And I mean, we live in a very judgy world. Mm. Social media is very judgy. But at this point, I'm like, well, you know, people will like you or not like you, as the case may be. Yeah. And what is that wonderful line? Other people's opinion of me is none of my business. I can't remember who said it. Someone very clever. But yeah, so I would just, this is me. This is my truth. One, I began to think about mortality in the sense that you're talking about when you put your head above the parapet when I had my kids, because suddenly I was thinking, I have to be there for them and I will, you know, kill to be there. Mm-hmm. So I was very aware of the concept of mortality, and having cancer just pushes that a bit more, because it's like, OK, I really, really have to work hard at being there for them. And it's very, very powerful.
And how are you?
I'm good. I have a reasonably aggressive cancer, but I am cancer free. I had the last time we had to reschedule this meeting, I was going in to have a second surgery. So I had, 20 years ago, as I say to people, I wouldn't have been around. You know, it's an aggressive cancer, but this immunotherapy drug, and we can go into the Luke O'Neill. I love your Luke O'Neill. I just love him. I think he's brilliant. So, there's this immunotherapy drug, or monoclonal antibody called Herceptin, and I'm on that. And so you get that and you get chemo and then you have surgery, and I remain on this Herceptin drug for the next, you know, few months. And then I'm now waiting for radiation. And then I'm clear of cancer. I've gone through those stages and it's just radiation. And then, you know, you just get on with my life. I don't see cancer as having defined me, but it's useful to talk about it. I mean, it's like I'm a UNICEF ambassador. I love going out there talking about using my voice. I think if you, I think if you have a voice where you can use it in some way to, I don't know, help society, do something good, you should do that.
And definitely. Especially if you're articulate enough to do it.
Yeah.
Chemo is fascinating, because for as long as we've all been alive, we've heard about chemo, and obviously things have changed. Probably the style of it has changed, but I know nothing about it. So all I know is apparently you sit in a room, boring, and you sit with a drip, just sit there and look out the window, or read in your case or something.
Yeah.
But what is it? How does it affect you? And what are the bad effects? No good effects that you can feel.
I had a friend, Emma Hannigan, who had a lot of chemo. So I had been with her in what they call the day oncology, where you sit in the chair. So I knew how it went. So you go in, you know, you get your bloods done, and your bloods have to be at a certain level before they give you the chemo. And if you get the go ahead, you take your first anti-nausea drug. They bung on the drip. There's an anti-nausea drug in that. There's a bit of fluids. You sit there, and every time they change the bag, you say, oh, I'm going to go to the loo. You know, you belt out to the loo or whatever. And then they bring in, we'll say, the first. So I was on Herceptin and Phesgo, which were an injection. And I was on a thing called carboplatin and Taxol, or Taxotere. And they would come separately. And, the nurses wear gloves when they are carrying these pouches. And you're going, Jesus, they're wearing gloves. This is terrible. So in the beginning, I had my first one in my hand. And that's OK. And sometimes it can burn, but I didn't feel a burn. Mm. And then I got a port in my chest, and I have a very nice port scar. Here's my port scar. I'm thinking of getting, you know, a tattoo on it or something. I am actually, seriously, but tattoos don't go well in MRI machines, so I have to work around this. So I got a port, which is a brilliant thing. I used to consider it like my little Tamagotchi. I thought of it as a Tamagotchi. But anyway, so the port gets infected, so that has to be whipped out. Mm. So then we...
Well, you're like a plug-in electric vehicle.
You're like very like a plug-in electric vehicle, you know, and it's fabulous.
And they're very, very popular these days, Cathy. So you're just a hybrid, really.
I know, I was just a hybrid.
You're a Toyota Prius.
But this is it. It just had to come out. Then I got another yoke, which goes in your arm, and then I got cloth from that. So that had to come out. So basically, I had a lot of... going into my hand.
Does it make you feel ill, sick?
Oh, does it make you feel ill? Anyway, we'll finish it. So you have all your, you've taken some steroids. So you go home the very first day you have chemo, you go home. I cut the hedge. I was like, I am woman, hear me roar.
Yeah.
And then the next day I started to vibrate. I was like sort of, I had been plugged in or that I was sitting on the washing machine on the final spin. And I thought, okay, well, I can cope with this. And suddenly about lunchtime the next day, ping, had to lie down, felt sicker than I've ever felt in my life. So then by the third session of this, it is cumulative. So I was just, I think by the third session, I was feeling so bad. And it turned out every time you have chemo, your white cell count goes right down. Mm. So you have to keep away from people in case you get an infection.
Okay.
And on the third day, you take this injection to make your, you know, stimulate your bone marrow, which can be quite, the injection isn't painful, but the feeling of your bone marrow being stimulated can be. Mm. But I got pneumonia, so I ended up having to go into hospital and be in A&E and all that sort of thing. So you feel so appallingly rotten. And it's very hard to know what's normal. And you're saying to them, I was so sick. And you're wondering, am I just a whiny old cow or is this normal? Mm. It's a weird one. So eventually, with lovely Professor Crown.
John Crown, yeah.
John Crown, amazing man. And fabulous team, fabulous nurses and doctors. So he took me off the carboplatin at the end. Because it was just, I did think I was going to die. I used to lie in bed sort of saying, I can't eat, I can't drink, I'm going to have a heart attack. So, you do go through the long, dark tea time of the soul while you're feeling run. But not everyone feels like that. Mm. You know, some people fly through it. Some people exercise while they're having chemotherapy. I mean, like not actually while they are plugged in, but you know. So, you know, after about 2 weeks, you're starting to feel normal. And then you have this fabulous week when you're normal and the whole world is a beautiful place. And then you have to go back in again because I was having it every 3 weeks. So it's a tough old thing to do. Mm. And I had this book written before I had chemo because I wouldn't have been able to do it. I mean, I was...
Yeah, of course not. The thing I find is just about creativity. I'm just trying to tap into this thing about creativity and I could not... I don't know if I could see a day where if I was feeling terrible. So, for example, let's say, God forbid, somebody close to me had an accident, even just hit by a car, but they weren't dead. I wouldn't be able to write a sketch.
No, of course
I mean,
you wouldn't.
Come on.
No, of course you wouldn't.
So similarly, I think if I had a very serious health issue, I think for at least days, weeks, I wouldn't be able to write a sketch, not because of the sickness, but because my brain would have been diverted into wondering constantly. And I often feel that you need some sort of stability, happiness, health.
You do.
To be creative.
No, you totally do. I mean, in the beginning, when I was diagnosed, I started writing about it. I was like, oh, you know, and today, and I was very stimulated by it because, I don't know, just I wanted to write about it. Mm. And then the very first day I brought my laptop in and darling Emma had written so many books when she was having chemo. So I was like, I'm going to write a book now here. So I started a new book the very first day and I really never went very far with it because thereafter I was, you know, I knew I was going to be wrecked. I was like, forget book, we are just going to have to rest. It was so exhausting. So I would just bring in a book or I would download some films or I'd have crochet or I'd sit there sort of in a, you know, bit of an old coma going, this is lovely. And also I wasn't getting out because I was terrified of getting COVID because I'd got pneumonia. So going into chemo was like, oh my God, we're at a party here and you'd see other human beings. Mm. Now, granted, everyone was sitting in their little chair and but the nurses and you could get a cup of tea and it was so exciting. It was meeting people, you know. Yeah. The Vincent's party. Yeah. Oncology day.
Yeah. So you now are feeling well?
I'm feeling well. I mean, I'm compared to chemo. So I've had chemo, I've had a couple of surgeries, I'm cancer free, I am still, I mean, the effects of chemo take a while to get over. So there's a serious fatigue issue.
Okay.
And Herceptin is a bit tough on the body. So I am, all my joints are sort of, for a while I was going, what's wrong with me?
A little bit achy.
Oh, yeah, 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 very achy. Mm. But do you know what? Like, there we go. That's the price to be paid. You keep going on. I'm a big believer in keep marching on. Mm. And I'll have radiation, and then they tattoo you, you see, apparently, which is very exciting. Mm. So I'm going to ask them what special tattoo ink they use so I can get that recreated whenever I'm going to get my, yo, I beat cancer, you know, thing or whatever. I spent a lot of time looking at tattoos going, oh, that's lovely. Yeah. That's a little Irishy thing, yeah.
All right, listen, the thing about this podcast is that sometimes when I have a guest on the podcast, I sort of basically send out a kind of an APB or an alert to the media going, I'm going to be having somebody on. Is there anybody that wants to listen in live and everything, right? So obviously it was you coming on, so I put the word out to a few people.
Ooh,
and you get the yay or the nay, right? So I have put on your headphones.
Oh, well, this is so exciting.
Yeah, so some people are on the phone there. So Bertie Ahern is on the phone there if you want to talk to him.
Bertie, sweetie, we share a birthday, darling.
How are you, Cathy? Bertie Ahern here. I was listening into the conversation. I know that we share a birthday, September 12th.
That's lovely.
We're both Virgos.
Yeah, yeah, we are. Yeah,
perfectionists.
And tidy and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Tidy. I'm very tidy. It's not my house, but it's somebody else's. Well, it was a friend of mine that gave this to me.
But you had the cupboard tidy. That was lovely.
It was very tidy. But I just wanted to ask you about the writing.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I wrote a book myself.
Did you do a book?
I did a book about book. Now I didn't get. Do you get the artist's exemption?
Yes, I do. But listen, a lot of people get the artist's exemption. You don't have to be making it up, or are you? Might.
Well, you see, that's the thing. They said I said a lot of people said mine was fiction, but I didn't get any. I didn't get a tax break on it because it didn't. They said it should have been in the fiction category. So I said, well, if I'm in the fiction category, why aren't I getting the 50 grand from the tax exemption?
Yeah, that's disgraceful. I would organise that. We'll talk to my accountant later, yeah. Pat. It'll be grand. But on the cupboard, do more cupboard work.
I can't wait to read Sisterhood.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
Well, I love women. Thanks.
Thanks, Bertie. That's weird.
Yeah,
Bertie. He wouldn't have thought he was a fan of yours.
No,
but do you know why?
Cecilia.
That's it. Cecilia Ahern.
Cecilia is a beautiful, beautiful girl and a fabulous writer.
That's why he was interested in you.
That's why he was interested in me, you see. And we are with the same publishers.
No,
we have been to parties and everything.
Paul Williams is on the line. Say hello to him.
Paul!
Hi, Cathy. Paul Williams here in Leitrim. I can't believe you're exposing this new group of animals that we know as the women's fiction scumbags. Cathy the Cable Tie Kelly. Patricia Scarface Scanlon. Maeve Bunsen Burner Binchy.
Do you remember the time that I nailed somebody's hand to the pool table? Do you remember that?
I remember.
Yeah.
You're a scumbag and a psycho.
This is too funny. This is too funny to someone.
Do you know who I'm sorry
Paul.
For?
Who?
Cancer.
Yes.
I'm sorry for cancer and what you're going to do to it.
Yes. You know me well, Paul. You're dead right there.
The people of Ireland are going to be crucified by your next bot novel. I know they are.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Sisterhood. Sisterhood of scumbags.
God, he's a bit bitter, isn't he?
Oh, God.
Thanks, Paul.
I do you know what? Paul is amazing, and Paul has been a friend of mine for a long time, and I haven't seen him for ages, but anyway, a long time ago, he was the only person who stood up for me in a very difficult situation, and I will never in a million years forget it for him. Anyway, there you go.
Another call. You're popular.
Oh, who's
Roy Keane is on the line.
Roy, I love Roy.
Say hello to Roy.
Hello, Roy. Have you got one of them Labrador puppies with you? I love the work you do with the blind.
How's it going? It's nice to talk to you. I have to say I'm not impressed.
Why not?
When you said you were going on about getting chemo and that you were looking at people exercising, you said you wouldn't dream of exercising during chemo. Why aren't you out training?
But
you know, it's only chemo.
I know, but you see the pitch.
Could you not do a little run and a couple of laps?
The pitch was, but the pitch had holes in it. You know.
You're giving out about your hair. Jesus, when I was bald I was at my most ruthless. I was killing people when I was bald. And then you're saying, oh, I'm a bit tired. I'm a bit achy.
There's no excuse.
Yeah.
No excuse.
Get out and start training.
Okay.
Get the bag on you and start training.
Yes, Captain.
Jesus Christ.
He's just fabulous. I love him for the work he does for the Guide Dogs for the Blind. It is so amazing. Sorry, I'll shut up now.
No, don't shut up. There's loads of other people who want to say hello to you. Fintan O'Toole is on the line.
I'm an enormous fan of Fintan O'Toole.
Say hello to Fintan.
Hello, Fintan. I love you. You are just brilliant.
Hello, Cathy. And in a sense, you are one of the greatest celebrators of my work. And thank you. I'm thinking of engaging in a profitable pursuit, and that might be Fintan O'Toole writes women's fiction.
Okay.
Do you think that's a possibility?
We might need to sit down and talk about that, you know.
Maybe I could change sex myself.
And
transgender Fintan O'Toole?
I believe it would be hard surgery. So
it could be hard hitting social commentary mixed with fluffy clogs and shawls.
Fluffy clogs and shawls. That sounds amazing. That sounds like a very millennial sort of way of looking at things. I think that sounds fabulous. But there's possibly more money to be made in the columns.
Did you say money?
Money.
I'm interested in money. Say that again.
Yeah, money.
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 Okay, I'm interested in money.
Money.
My last book made some money, but I'm interested in making real cash.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean real hard cash.
Okay, hard
cash. Cash that can't be traced.
Okay.
I don't like the revenue.
Okay, Botox. Clearly Botox is the way to go.
Is Botox sell?
Yeah, Botox. Okay. Yeah, start importing
Fintana
Botox.
Fintana O'Toole, Botox, social. Ah.
God, he's mad. He's great. He's great. You have so many fans, see?
Yeah, I know.
To get Roy Keane and Bertie Ahern
on the same podcast. On the same podcast. You know what? Fintan O'Toole, isn't he just amazing? I love his columns and he's so respected around the world. And he's
there a fraternity of women's?
There is totally a fraternity.
There? Lovely. I love to hear that.
No, there is. I mean, and people loved the concept that we'd all be killing each other and ripping each other's eyes out. Mm. And I hate that. Mm. You know, we all get on. We
so
all
there
support
is generally
each other.
A good camaraderie.
There is an amazing camaraderie. Mm. Do you know what? I meant to text Marion Keyes because I had a very strange dream last night that I had met Marion and I was minding some animals that were either sorry, you shouldn't be really talking about your dreams on the radio, should you?
Of course you
anyway,
should.
But I was minding some animals that they were sort of half rabbits, half, you know, mice, and they were white and I was minding them, and somehow I met up with some disreputable woman who, and I banged into Marion, and the woman cloned Marion's phone and was reading her new book, and I woke up this morning and thought, she's better ring Marion and tell her to watch her phone, and then I thought, stop, you know, she already knows you're mad, you don't need to be proving it. But yeah, no, we're friends. Yeah. We used to have this bet. Okay, I'm going to say this. So me and Sheila and Patricia and Marion used to meet for what we called our office Christmas lunch, because we didn't have offices anymore, right? And, you know, people would always ask us loads of questions, which was, did you always want to be a writer? And the joke was, one of us was going to say one day, no, I wanted to be a porn star. So the person who was going to say this first was going to win the bet, because people would be shocked at the concept. But, you know, we like a joke. Anyhow, so I've already said it. I said it before, but I still haven't won the bet. And we didn't set on what the
Who did you say to? Pat Kenny?
No, I didn't.
When did you want to be a writer? And you went, I wanted to be a porn star, Pat. Oh, my God, why do they always make me look like a plank? Listen, Cathy, I'm so thrilled to have talked to you. And have you got a 24th book planned?
Yes, I have a 24th book planned.
Can you tell us anything about it?
I can tell you absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Because it's in its early stages.
Not even a name?
No, not even a name.
When does the name come? First, middle or last?
Oh, Jeannie Macaroni's. I don't know, about halfway through with this book. Currently, book 24 is called book 24, so I don't, you know, lose it on the computer, which
I... Do you ever think of doing an Adele on it and just calling it by a number?
I know, wouldn't you love that?
She just calls her, 17, 19, 24?
No, but she's just fabulous, isn't she? I just love her. That music's amazing.
Yeah.
That wouldn't really work as a title. Well, maybe it would. I'm trying to think of any books that were called... Mm. What was that one? Child...
Porn Star.
Yeah, really.
Chemo porn star.
I don't know. That'd be very different market.
Porn star chemo sounds like a cocktail.
Yeah, it does actually, doesn't it?
How are you, Tony? Give us a porn star chemo there and a bag of Pat Kenny's.
Bag of scampi fries. Yeah, yeah. Porn star chemo. I mean, I could do that. I've often thought of writing a thriller, but I could, you know, maybe whack out a sort of, you know, funny 8 Club 18 to 30, you know, novel. You know, and Porn Star Chemo would work with that.
Porn Star Chemo is a great name.
Yeah, the old wet t-shirt competition and it all goes further, yeah.
Yeah, stick with Porn Star Chemo. I'll give it to you for nothing.
Okay, that is excellent. Thank
Kathy
you.
Kathy Kelly, thank you so much. And I met you once on the street.
Yes,
and,
yes.
We had a little hug.
We
and,
did.
And
you
were so
you.
Nice. Ah, oh, you were so nice to me. And it's all right back at you. Mwah, mwah. Mwah. I wish you very well with all your books and
thank
with any
so
treatment
much.
That you have. And I'm so delighted to see you so well.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this week from my podcast. You can get in touch with me, mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I read them all and I get back to most of them. And if you have any tips, suggestions, guest ideas, sketch ideas, comments, constructive criticism, I'm open for it all. And please, if you can, tell one other person about this podcast. Thanks. See you same time, same place next week.